is a Bramble Jam podcast.
Hi, I'm Dan, and I love movies, which means I'm also a film critic.
Hi, I'm Alonzo. I'm a film critic, which means I also love movies. And this is a film.
And a movie. And welcome to the first ever edition of A Film and a Movie. I'm super excited to be here. Alonzo, how you doing?
I'm excellent. I'm really thrilled to see where this thing's going to go. And you know, I haven't seen all these movies myself, so we're going to get to a lot of classics that are big gaps in my own film education.
Yeah, and while Alonzo is being quite modest, he is the professional film critic, and the reality is what we're trying to do here is kind of bring ourselves to a cross-section of modern-day movie-going and classic cinema, and we'll do that by watching two movies. They have some sort of connection. One is deemed a classic. The other is one that you've probably heard of and seen, and maybe it'll inspire you to go and check out that old classic or at least learn some film history along the way. And each and every week, we're going to try to have a guest that's also a film critic, and this week is no exception. We have from Roger Ebert. And the New York Times and many other places. Matt Zoller-Seitz is with us, and we're super excited to have him. Matt, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, I mean, it's a privilege, I'm sure, for you to be on the first ever edition of this highly touted podcast.
I'll try not to drool.
Yeah. Do your best. So without any further ado, we've picked two movies that have quite a connection between the two of them. We have 2016's La La Land, directed by Damien Chazelle. And then we have The Umbrellas of Cherbourg from 1964. And this is a movie that I had not seen before this podcast, so I'm really excited to talk about it. And basically, the way this is going to work is we're going to give you a synopsis of each movie, and then we're going to dive into the movie, the newer edition first, and then we're going to kind of backtrack and talk about the classic film and kind of how they relate and the things that you may be able to pull from each of these films. So are we ready to get started? You want to go first with The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, and we'll go from there?
Sure, yeah. So in a nutshell, written and directed by Jacques Demy, this is a romance about a young couple in the French city of Cherbourg. He is an auto mechanic. She is a shop girl in a store that sells umbrellas. They are deeply in love. She's 17 years old. He's a little bit older than that. Her mother disapproves of the relationship, but the two of them are determined to see it through. He is called to his military service and is sent to Algeria to fight in the war there. And the night before he leaves, the two of them sleep together. Cut to months later, she finds herself pregnant. His letters are coming with less frequency. The store is in financial crisis, and the mother has a rich suitor that she would like for him to marry. She would like for her daughter to marry, and so it becomes a sort of tortured romantic tale of young love and what happens, and how sort of youthful idealism gives way to sort of the realities of the adult world. And what's novel about the film is that it is entirely sung from stem to stern. Every line of dialogue that comes out of anybody's mouth is put to beautiful melodies by Georges Delerue.
There you have it. And that was definitely the thing that stuck out to me initially. We'll get to that in a little bit. As I got to watch the movie, I was not prepared. So La La Land, as you may have already seen or heard, following the critical success of Whiplash, this is director Damien Chazelle's musical. He wrote and directed in 2016. It's a modern day musical set in the title city. It follows two star-crossed lovers based in Hollywood, pursuing very Hollywood-based occupations. There's big musical numbers. It stretches across the homes, bars, streets, and even highways of Los Angeles. It takes us on this journey of two star-crossed lovers, struggling barista Mia, Emma Stone, who's trying to make it out of traffic and into work. And between auditions, she's living that LA life of not really understanding if it's maybe right for her, and she feels kind of like she's drowning. And speaking of drowning, have you heard about jazz? That's right. No one cares about jazz. jazz anymore, except Sebastian. They call him Seb. That's Ryan Gosling. He's a musician. He's a purist. He cares about the art of jazz, and he'd rather be broke reviving a jazz club than rich playing anything that people still listen to. And then from the awkward meet cute to the second awkward meet cute to the third awkward meet cute, it's clear that Mia and Seb are destined musically to be together in some form or fashion. This new relationship is born, and with it grows the challenges of each character coinciding with the rise and fall of their respective careers. Mia is working on a one-woman show written and directed and starring her. Seb decides it's time to grow up and joins John Legend's band as a piano player and starts making money, but then he's never around. And so then we have to deal with if the, you know, the sellout was worth it, so to speak. Mia gets her big break as a couple break up, and they break up and go their separate ways. They both are successful at living their career dreams, having lost their true love in the process. And so this all culminates with an all-encompassing finale that brings the musical to a close, but also shows the cost of said pursuit, what might have been, and well as showing you kind of the fleeting vapor that is time in the process. It's bittersweet. It's melancholy. It's a musical, and it's Damien Chazelle's La La Land. That is the movie for this week's episode. So, with that being said, as always, I'll defer to you first, Alonzo. Give me just your opening thoughts a little bit on La La Land and what you thought when you saw it initially, and then maybe what you caught watching it a second time or however many times you saw it.
You know, it's funny. The first time I saw it was there was a very small sort of press preview screening in Los Angeles right before the Venice Film Festival, which is where the movie made its world premiere. And I saw it and I liked it, but I remember having some reservations about some specific things in terms of sort of character motivation and thinking maybe there needed to be like maybe one more musical number. But then I saw it again at the first press preview in Venice and was liked it so much more the second time that actually it's one of the few times that I had written a review and then went back and re-edited it and sort of changed it a bit.
Oh, wow.
before posting it, because I the things that had bothered me in the first viewing were sort of less of an issue for me. Matt, what about you? What was your what were your early takes?
Well, I almost wonder if I'm ever gonna really have a viewing of this movie that's not affected so much by external factors that I can't get a read on it. But I saw it in New York. I don't remember exactly what the opening date was, but it was, I saw it fairly close to its release date, and it was after the November 2016 election. Oh, wow. And I remember thinking, wow, this is kind of what I needed right now, something very light and sweet and essentially optimistic and with, you know, attractive people dancing and singing, but also thinking that this felt like a pre-Trump movie. To me, like, it felt like the last gasp of the Obama era, like where we kind of didn't know what we were about to get into or how comparatively good we had it. So I was consumed with melancholy on my way out of the theater, while also feeling kind of a spring in my step at the same time. And I didn't think that it was a particularly deep film, but I didn't feel like it was trying to be. There were a few things that bothered me, and I will say that I come from a family of jazz musicians, and my father is a composer and pianist, Dave Zoller, and he writes charts for big bands that are used in universities and plays club dates, and he has a discography and everything. So I'm more conversant in jazz than most people, and I legitimately love it. Like, it's really an important part of my life. And I have to say that I, as a result of all that, I wanted to slap Ryan Gosling constantly, because I thought, you know, I've written pieces for various publications, including the New York Times. I've reviewed jazz documentaries. They did a huge retrospective of jazz films about 13, 14 years ago, and I wrote a piece on it for the New York Times. And so I take this seriously, and I'm not a humorless person about it, and I'm not like Ryan Gosling treating it like I'm spreading the gospel to the unwashed masses. Jazz is fun. Jazz is interesting, and I think. I don't know how this happened exactly, but it's become this like an eat your vegetables thing. And it's like, no, it's people improvising and on a melody and having a great time. And it's, it's art, and it's also math, and it's all of these other, and it's kind of an acrobatic, athletic display of skill. Like, there's no reason not to have fun listening to jazz and watching jazz. And this guy treated it like it was like he was trying to save the last Siberian tiger or something. It's like, man, lighten up! What's wrong with you? And then on top of it, he was such a just an asshole. Like when he, that scene, I'm sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to curse on this, but okay, so that scene where he's at the party and he has to play with that band, I think they're playing some kind of I don't know 80s music or something, and he's dressed up and he's got this scowl on his face the entire time. It's like, you jerk, man. Like if I were a musician and I was trying to make a living playing music, which is almost impossible to do. Almost impossible to do. Like, even if you're famous, it's almost impossible to do. If I got a paid gig, if it was the worst music in the history of the world, I would have a smile on my face and I would be in a great mood. And he's mad because it's not the kind of music he wants to play. And he takes her to the jazz club, and as soon as the band starts to play, he turns to her and starts to talk. What kind of a jazz fan are you, man? What is wrong with you? So, yeah, I had issues.
I can't help taking it personally when he's too cool to play Christmas music at the restaurant at the beginning of the movie. It's like, hey, come on, it's December, man.
It seems like
chill out on the jazzbo action and just play Jingle Bells.
I just went to visit my dad in Dallas, and we watched the Miles Davis documentary together, and there was a whole section about how he took inspiration from things like, Disney musicals and, like, really, really... light-hearted, simple pop songs, and he genuinely loved them. Like, he wasn't being ironic. And Miles Davis was not known as being like a happy-go-lucky dude. But but if he can love "Someday My Prince Will Come" and it can become one of his most successful songs, then why can't Ryan Gosling smile a little bit when he's at that pool party?
I think I felt like Ryan Gosling was somehow annoyed that he had to play the music. He literally had to play the whole movie. Like, very rarely is he not annoyed by playing it. And I did, the first time I watched this movie, I did leave going, the people that still like jazz love jazz, right? Like, the core of jazz is still a fun, like, thriving community. It's not a, like, the fact that, and I hope that came across sarcastic in my synopsis, but, like, it did very much seem like he was Don Quixote of jazz. Like, he was the guy that was trying to save jazz. It's like, somebody's got to do it. It may as well be the Gosling. Like, I didn't make any sense.
He's the Lorax.
That's right.
I'm well aware that many of my colleagues loathe the film. I don't, but one of the complaints they have against it is that, it's about a character who's trying to save jazz. And I don't know that he's trying to save it necessarily in quite that way. He does come across that way. And at the end, he doesn't actually save jazz. He just opens up a club. And the question of, I want to know who backed this club in this day and age, because it's really quite a nice piece of work. But I think maybe that's a fantasy sequence. I was never quite sure how to take that ending.
No, the actual club is for real. The fantasy is sort of the thing within it when he's playing the piano and imagines what their life together would have been. I think when she and Tom Everett Scott walk in, that's supposed to be for real.
Oh, okay.
That's how I took it. Correct. So now, Matt, you said you walked out after 16, but you didn't tell us about your viewing in present day. Did you have a different experience viewing it recently?
Yeah, I tried to rewatch it again with my wife, who is... unfortunately passed away this year, but she,
oh my goodness, I'm sorry.
Yeah, but she was a musical theater performer and attended the Music Conservatory in Cincinnati and loved Broadway musicals. And I must say that her latitude in terms of what types of musicals she will accept is a lot narrower than mine. Basically, if they can't sing, she doesn't want to watch it. She's not interested. Like, she won't watch Guys and Dolls because she thinks Marlon Brando ruins it. Just like, she's very much an absolutist. So I was like, let's watch La La Land. She's like, She didn't last more than 15 minutes and I bailed. So there was that. So again, that was the other, when I mentioned external factors affecting my ability to respond to the movie, that's another one. I was watching it with somebody who was opposed to the very idea of non-singers being stars of a musical. But Demi did that too.
Yes. You did.
True. Well, no one's singing in that movie. They're all dubbed.
Right. And you know, but which is a better solution in some ways, but we kind of decided we can't do that anymore. And I don't know how that happened, maybe.
I blame Les Mis.
Well, you know, I think there was the sort of the Marnie Nixification of, you know, 60s musicals where you had like the same woman who was the voice of Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady and Natalie Wood in West Side Story. And then it became also this thing where, you know, musicals in the 60s became such big box office and then hence so expensive to make that you had to cast marquee names. And unlike the days of MGM, where you had big name stars who could also sing and dance, you now had to sort of pick one or the other, which is how you wind up with Lee Marvin and Clint Eastwood in Paint Your Wagon.
I was wondering how long it would be before we could make fun of Paint Your Wagon. That's a tradition going back to the 80s with us.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, let's not even talk about Lost Horizon, you know, with as Bette Midler once famously said, I never miss a Liv Ullmann musical. I watched La La Land again last night, and I have to say, like, yeah, the jazz stuff sticks in my craw more than ever in terms of just how unbearable he is about it. But I think for the most part, otherwise, it works really well. Yes, they are not sort of traditional singers, but I think that the movie is operating in this sort of like an LA you recognize and a sort of dreamlike, you know, idealized LA, that them not being, you know, perfect contraltos or whatever kind of fits the at least attempt at a recognizable world being shown in the movie.
Yeah. So I watched, obviously I saw it when it came out down here in South Carolina. We just have to hear about the buzz of a movie for years before we get to watch it. I said the Les Mis thing earlier. I honestly blame that modern update of Les Mis where I heard for months, you don't understand, Daniel, they're actually singing. They're actually doing the singing in real time. Like, who cares, man? Who cares? I mean, we still have to listen to Russell Crowe. I don't care. But I remember seeing this movie, and I'm not a professional, but for me, like, you have two things that are very, very important in a musical. It's the music and the characters. And I think the characters in this movie, overly quixotic, are good characters and they're well acted. The music to me, the opening number of La La Land, I was blown away. Like when I saw the opening number and they're all dancing on the highway, I was like, man, that is quite a piece of filmmaking. It looks like it's going to be a lot of fun. And I consistently was underwhelmed more as the movie went on. And so for me, the music there's not a memorable song in the movie. Like I don't have a song that I could go to and be like,
I can't remember the melody to any of them right now.
Yeah, I can't either. I think there's City of Stars was the one I was like, oh, I kind of remember this song, but it doesn't have a standout musical number, and neither does Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which we'll get to. But I feel like, and we'll also get to this later, my appreciation for La La Land, at least for Damien Chazelle's love of old films, grew after watching Umbrellas of Cherbourg, but my enjoyment of the movie did not grow at all. It was exactly what it was. I thought there was some good filmmaking involved, but as we went along in the movie, I was just kind of dragged down by the things that just, I don't know, whether it was the jazz or whether it was the fact that they're not professional singers. It just kind of weighed more than it should have as a movie that should be lighthearted and a flight of fancy and this fun, like, dream world of Los Angeles. I just, it never really resonated for me, I think, like it probably should have. That was my take.
I don't mind the idea of casting people whose main thing is not singing. That doesn't really bother me. I mean, I like, I understand that that's kind of a tradition within the movie musical is movie musicals starring people who, it's very rare that there's someone who flat out can't sing. I mean, even in the, you know, everybody makes fun of the Les Mis film, but the people in that can sing. Russell Crowe can sing better than most people can sing. He's just not up to the level. He's a musician, too, but he's not up to the level of, like, a Broadway singer, which is kind of what you want when you see this. And Alonzo, you pointed out, I think that's so true, is, you know, there was this infrastructure up until roughly the 50s, early 60s, where the studios were producing talent that would star in musicals. Like they had training programs. And in fact, my own mother was very briefly part of one. I don't know if you know this, but she was, Yeah, she went to 20th Century Fox as a child when they were looking to replace Shirley Temple, and she was one of the little girls who they were hoping would replace Shirley Temple. And it didn't work out for a variety of reasons, but basically the story she told me about, like, they were taking tap classes and singing classes and posture classes and vocal coaching for speaking and all kinds of stuff. And now I think your best bet is you either got to hope that there's an actor who can also really, 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 really sing, or you get a singer. And I think the movie that did that, I think, very well recently was the remake of A Star Is Born. Both of them can sing. They can really sing. And that helped tremendously to put it across. You didn't have to just imagine that one of the two of them could sing. Like, Bradley Cooper held his own very well.
Yeah. And also, A Star Is Born is a movie where it helps that the songs they're being asked to sing are within, like, the rock and country genres, which is different than, like, because, yeah, Russell Crowe has a bar band and has a perfect voice for that kind of thing. But when it comes to Broadway, that's something else entirely, you know. And sadly, so often, you know, when Broadway hits get turned into movies, rather than cast the original people, they will turn to the more famous, you know, like most recently, like in Fosse Verdon, there's the whole thing where Gwen Verdon has to see Sweet Charity get turned over to Shirley MacLaine in the movie because, you know, she's a name that sells tickets and Gwen Verdon is not a name outside of Broadway. And so there is this whole sort of economic thing forcing it. The thing about La La Land, I think that I respond to so much just as somebody who loves musicals in general is like, in my lifetime, I have seen, like, I when I was a kid was sort of the death knell of the sort of 60s mega musical, you know, all those expensive flops that followed in the wake of Sound of Music and Mary Poppins. You know, occasional stabs at like, you know, Broadway adaptations or whatever. But this was a full-on original screen musical, which happens so very rarely. And it was one that was so committed to that. Like, from that opening number with just the color scheme, and we'll talk about that when we get to Umbrellas, and the, you know, the closing down the highway, to that finale fantasy sequence where they're going pure Vincent Minnelli and walking through these painted sets of Los Angeles. I was like, I love that someone is doing this and trying this, and it might not be hitting 1,000 every time, but I love that they're making the effort and that it's working more often than it's not working.
Oh, I think Chazelle is a hugely talented filmmaker, and I don't understand, you know, I know there's kind of a naysaying corner of the internet about him, but I think what he's doing is very impressive, and I also think that to a certain extent, all of his movies have been misunderstood and in some cases condemned for things that they are not trying to be and not trying to do, and that's
right.
That's apart from the question of whether or not you personally respond to them, and there's all sorts of subjective factors that go into that that you can't really do anything about, but Whiplash, like, I had all these arguments with people saying, you know, well, Whiplash is not an accurate representation of music education. And I'm like,
really?
Like, you know, like a guy like that would never be allowed to be a teacher. And I'm like, guys, this is a horror fantasy about a mentor. I'm like, what I love about that movie is it's this perverse upside down version of the inspirational teacher story.
Yes.
Like, instead of it being about the one teacher who made a difference, it's the one teacher who ruined everything for you.
Mr. Holland's torture.
Yes.
Yeah. Like, I've been watching The Last Dance on ESPN, and Michael Jordan is a legitimate monster if you've not watched it. Like, he legitimately doesn't care about anyone or anything except for winning. And, like, he is pretty much J.K. Simmons from Whiplash. Like, that's who he is. Like, that's the teacher that he would have loved. I love Whiplash. I think it's a great movie. And I do think Chazelle's incredibly talented. First Man, which he didn't write, I think still was a really well-made movie. And I'm pretty sure Damien Chazelle is a musician as well. And I think that there's this natural, like, even the parts of La La Land I didn't enjoy, I think the commitment to a musical is clearly there. There's no doubt about it. And the commitment to doing that. And Mandy Moore, who choreographed it, and she choreographs a show on NBC called Zoe's Extraordinary Playlist. She's like, I didn't know that Mandy Moore was that big into choreography.
It's not that Mandy Moore.
Oh, okay. I was about to say. Yeah. But yeah, it's the same.
Where does she find the time?
Yeah.
Same name, but yeah, two different people. She also choreographed the new Valley Girl remake, which is better than one might think.
Really?
Yes. It's actually kind of charming. So this is sort of our first crack at this show. And we're going to talk about movies that are direct remakes of other films, ones that sort of carry different strains of DNA. These two movies, I think, have a lot of connection, and it's kind of handed to me on a platter. I have to say this pair, because Chazelle's very first feature film that he made before Whiplash is an indie movie with a couple of musical sequences, and its title is Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench.
Oh my gosh.
And Guy and Madeline are two of the major characters in The Umbrellas of Cherbourg. So he's tipping his hat to Jacques Demy just out of the gate.
That's interesting. Yeah, and I also think there's one other thing we should talk about, which is there is another sort of, I guess I hesitate to use the word problem, but factor here with him being influenced by that, which is the characters in Umbrellas of Cherbourg are dealing with real stuff, like on the ground, heavy duty, basic stuff, and they're connected, and it's you know, the colors are beautiful and the compositions are very thoughtful, and it is sort of drawing on this lush Technicolor kind of Hollywood musical tradition, and it's making it French, and that's all wonderful. But we're talking about the story of a teenage girl who gets pregnant by her boyfriend, who's drafted into the Algerian War and might conceivably be killed fighting, you know, a war that was very controversial and ultimately unpopular. And there's economic deprivation and all of these other things. And in La La Land, there's really none of that. It's really untethered. So there's no tension. There's no tension. And that was another thing that kept me from wanting to go back and see it again, is I like tension either in the story of the characters themselves or in the things that are being presented and the way they are being presented to you. And like in the second case, if those two things don't match up, like the subject matter and the style, sometimes it can be a disaster, but otherwise it can be the thing that makes the movie really interesting. Like I think about how in Taxi Driver, you've got this story of this lonely, psychotic Vietnam veteran and cab driver, and it's done in the style of like a neo-noir or a crime thriller or something. And almost like it's so lush that it's almost like those late period Hitchcock films like Vertigo, which obviously Scorsese worships. And you know, it kind of keeps you off kilter, and I was hoping that there would be a little more of that in La La Land. I guess I wanted it to be like not quite as much of a dessert, I suppose, and maybe that's unfair. But there were points where I was like, I don't know, this kind of like, if you strip out the musical numbers, this reminds me of, it would be the kind of indie movie that you would see at a festival and go, eh, and then it would never get an actual release.
Well, I think, and I heard that Chazelle had written the script for La La Land like in 2010, and no one would make it until he made Whiplash, which doesn't surprise me. But when I watched Umbrellas of Cherbourg, what stuck out to me is kind of along the lines of what you said, is the villain of that movie is tradition. Like the tradition of, hey, when a 17-year-old girl in 1964 gets pregnant, she better get a husband real quick because she can't, you know, when the country calls for you to go to war, regardless of how you feel about that war, you go to war. There's no bad person in Umbrellas of Cherbourg, but the tradition of how we've always done things causes that dramatic tension. Like that's the villain, is we have to do this because it's the thing we've always done. The mom always raises the kid. Like he doesn't even, there's no part of that movie where Guy is fighting for his child back, because it's the tradition that she had to find some, you know, a husband, and he has to be the, you know, pseudo father or whatever. Whereas in La La Land, the villain of La La Land is, I guess, success is how to balance success and love and try to determine like what your primary motivation is in those two. And it isn't nearly as lasting an impression, at least for me.
I'll say this. I think that while there's a lot of influence of umbrellas in La La Land, the way that they use the primary colors, the sort of bittersweet, you know, ending, the fact that the lovers don't wind up together, you know, I think that you could say thematically, in terms of it being about people, you know, artists who are trying to sort of like rise in station and fulfill their artistic ambitions, that is more of what Demy's follow-up film, The Young Girls of Rochefort, is about. Catherine Deneuve, again, and her real-life sister, Françoise Dorléac, play twins. One of them is a musician, one of them is a dancer, and they want to get the hell out of Rochefort, basically, and like go to Paris and, you know, be in the orchestra or be in the ballet or whatever. And so I think plot-wise, La La Land owes more to that movie, but I think in a lot of other ways, it comes out of the tradition of Rochefort, because I think it what caught a lot of people by surprise about La La Land was they might have never seen a musical with a sad ending before. I know on Linoleum Knife, one of our listeners who was a high schooler at the time, and you know we still hear from her periodically, but she would talk about how she and her friends would go see La La Land like every weekend and just cry and cry and cry, and they couldn't believe it, you know. And so I think the notion of, because I think people think that musicals operate in such a narrow path of like, you know, happy ending, get the girl, everything swell at the final fade out. And so for Chazelle to make a movie that's more like Cherbourg, where it's kind of bittersweet and you get a taste of like these people who remember this passion they had, but understand why they had to let it go and how their lives continued and how, you know, to quote the song, you know, is that all there is? You know, I thought I would die and then I didn't die. You know, I think that feeling in La La Land is very much there. And I think that for contemporary audiences, that came as a bit of a shock.
You know, there's a movie that came out a number of years ago. God, 13 years ago now, how time flies, that is a different way to approach the same kind of musical. And it was Romance and Cigarettes. Which I don't know if either of you have seen that, but it was
John Turturro.
It was written and directed by John Turturro, and it starred James Gandolfini, Susan Sarandon, and Kate Winslet, among other people. Steve Buscemi is in it, and Bobby Cannavale, and Mandy Moore, the other one. They're all in it. Elaine Stritch, Eddie Izzard. It's a really great cast, but it's about a guy who is torn between his wife and his mistress, and it's really quite charming. And it's also a movie where James Gandolfini is not the first name you would think of when you think, get me a guy who can really sing. And you know, Susan Sarandon can carry a tune. We saw that in Rocky Horror Picture Show. Kate Winslet's not bad, but like, it's not the point of the movie. Like, it's more this sort of like when the voice of the movie musical comes out of the mouths of ordinary working class characters, which is what these people are. But I really recommend that. Like, if you liked La La Land and you want to give another movie like that a shot, try Romance and Cigarettes.
Fair enough. I do feel like what was great, but when I watched La La Land a second time after watching Umbrellas of Cherbourg, I never thought Damien Chazelle has just made a copy of a movie. Like, what he made, clearly he has this love and adoration of these films, and he has a love and adoration of Umbrellas of Cherbourg and some others, but he's made something that could stand on its own. And that, like, made me, like I said, it made me appreciate what he had done and the style in which he had done it, even if I didn't particularly care for the movie more than I did on the first viewing.
And he has what I go ahead, sorry.
No, I was going to say, I think that there's going to be a recurring theme over the course of the show, Daniel. It's that we're going to see that artists are constantly being inspired by other artists, and it's a question of, you know, it's not, oh, you took that. It's what are you doing with the stolen goods?
Yeah, and you know, and on the bad end of that, you've got something like the Ben Affleck film, The Town, which, while being pretty good, there's never been a point where I was watching The Town again where I didn't think I'd rather be watching Heat. And there was, and it's,
oh my gosh.
And not only is it so close in tone and style to Heat, there was actually a scene in the movie where he was watching Heat on television, and he wisely cut that out.
There is, you're right.
So you know, there's that.
And this neon finger was pointing
at exactly, the exactly. And like, you know, Logan, I loved Logan, but the only part of Logan I would have asked him to cut if I was the producer is the scene where they're watching Shane, and it's like, it's too much.
Yes.
Yeah.
If people have seen Shane and they get the parallels, fine. But you know, like, the objective of this movie is to not get people to go rent Shane. You know, like, let's strike that from the list of things we're trying to accomplish.
Purely
here.
For Mangold's street cred, he wanted to be like, no, I've made a Wolverine movie already. It sucks, but this one, I'm going to remind you, it's good. It's rated R. It's got things. It's Shane.
And I am mindful of my reference points.
That's right.
I would like you to be as well.
You guys remember Shane? I do.
Well, there's but also Chazelle. Talking about Chazelle again, I like filmmakers who have a very strong voice and a kind of a thing that they're about. And he is, so far, I haven't seen that first film you mentioned, Alonzo, but It seems like he's all about doing things that seem almost perversely counterintuitive. And I like that. I like that. And I mentioned, you know, Miles Davis earlier, and God, I'm not saying they're in the same league, but like that sense of like, wow, a jazz trumpeter who spends most of a song not playing and has his back to the audience. That's weird. What the hell is that about? But in fact, that's like a lot of the specialness comes from having that mindset. And Chazelle in First Man, like, we've seen stories of astronauts many, many times, and we've never seen one where the camera is locked into the space that he happens to be in, whether it's the space capsule or his own kitchen where he's having an argument with his wife. And there were some reviews that came out at the time saying that it was really irritating that they almost never gave you an exterior shot of the spacecraft or the test plane that he was piloting. And it's like, yeah, but if you want that, go watch The Right Stuff or Apollo 13. Like, there's plenty of movies that show you the grandeur of space and what the Earth looks like when you're up in a capsule. This is not that movie. It's got a different set of fish to fry, and I thought it was cool.
Yeah, first person.
And once he gets out of the lunar, you know, module, and once he gets on the moon, Chazelle blows you away with space.
Yeah, and it's like, hey, here's the moon. It's great, and it's great. It's also because you get that sense of relief of, like, this is a guy whose entire career is predicated on being packed into a space the size of a car trunk, and finally he gets to get out and stretch his legs, and it's the moon.
It's freaking awesome. That's right. Yep.
Now, Dan, I did not warn you about the nonstop singing of Cherbourg. Were you taken aback, and how long did it take for you to sort of get used to it?
Yeah, I was not happy the first couple minutes of the movie when Homeboy pulls into the garage and they sing about an oil change. I was ready to turn it off like ASAP. I was like, I'm out. This podcast is dumb. And then once you get used to it, and I don't want to bring up Aaron Sorkin, but it has this rat-a-tat like feel to it, and like once you start to vibe with the movie, it becomes very second nature. It's like, sure, people that don't want to watch movies because of subtitles, well, this has subtitles as well, and I'm always like, you know, once you get used to subtitles, it's not, you know, like what Bong Joon-ho said, you know, people can't cross that two inch fence just to watch this great movie. And this was an added barrier that for the first few minutes, I mean, first of all, the opening, you know, title shots of the movie, the colors are just magnificent and wonderful. Mm. And I'm like, man, I'm ready for some big musical numbers. And it really doesn't have any big musical numbers. It's just music, yeah, from start. And in that way, it is similar to La La Land. There's not a big, I don't know the name of a song in that movie. They're always singing.
There are a couple of songs that we kind of can identify from the movie just because they were turned into pop hits later. Like her big lamenting song, the I Will Never Leave You, as he's going, was translated into English as I Will Wait For You, and was covered by like everybody. Like Sinatra did it, Louis Armstrong. Like it was a staple of the time.
Okay.
And then the song that the rich suitor sings about his past, which actually is a reference to him being that same character in an earlier Jacques Demy movie called Lola, was turned into a song called Watch What Happens.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't know any of that. That's awesome.
But
to know.
Yeah, but as far as like being big musical numbers where like, you know, 20 Koreans coming out with like, you know, tap dancing with, you know, marching band uniforms, like, yeah, there's never any of that.
Well, I thought it was going to be really annoying. Like I mean, if we got guys in a garage who were basically doing this bit, I thought it was going to be annoying. But basically what happened was, is it made, this is already the most microscopic, intimate musical I've ever seen. First of all, like the movie is far more intimate in scope than what musicals, when I think of a musical. And then you add this kind of rat-a-tat, we're singing every line all the time. It became something that stood completely on its own to me. And so I, at the beginning, I was very wary about it. But as it went on, and you can kind of see the writing on the wall and see where the movie's going and the heartbreak that's to come. And I just thought it really, you know, made it hit on all cylinders when you have this ability to have that intimacy created, not only in the scope of the film, but also in this very distinct style of how they sing. I thought it was wonderful.
There's also an aspect to it that I want to talk about, which is, I think both of these movies are very successful at being what I call experiences. And there are not enough movies or television shows that are experiences in the sense that you're not just following it for the plot and the characters, you are watching it for the experience of watching it, like the physical experience, the emotional experience of watching it. And then part of the reason that I used to watch Boardwalk Empire, even though in my opinion it was, you know, it was only occasionally on the level of the shows that it obviously wanted to be, like as a drama. But I watch it every week because of the clothes, the cars, the cinematography, the cigarette smoke. They would have occasionally, you'd be in a club and there'd be a dance number or somebody would sing. And it was just very decadent. Like the sheer level of production values was off the charts. And that's why I watch it. And I think it's a perfectly legitimate reason to watch things. And I do admire both of these movies for being that kind of viewing experience, you know, and I think there's a tendency, I don't know why, it's always been true of film criticism, to sort of fixate on the plot, the characters, and the themes, and not talk about all the other stuff, when all the other stuff is the reason why people keep going back to movies. I mean, the reason I've seen 2001 A Space Odyssey so many times is not because I want to ponder the philosophical questions, because, and there are philosophical questions in that movie, they're legit. It's because it's like now, it's at this point, it's like one of the, it's like a wonderful double album, and I know the songs really well, but they still bring me pleasure. And like when that Blue Danube starts up and the Pan Am ship starts to dock in the wheel shaped space station, I love it. I'm in heaven. You know, I just love to look at, you know, one thing's twirling and the other thing is straight, and it's, and there's stars and here's the Earth, and it's just beautiful. It's beautiful to look at. And what's wrong with that? Nothing.
Nothing. They're, in fact, both of these movies 100% succeed on a beauty scale. I mean, I think that they're both very beautiful to look at. I would not. I was really blown away by Cherbourg just for that alone. Was watching it going, man, this movie is almost 60 years old, and it is it's stunning.
The fact that a woman will be wearing a dress. And not only will the umbrella complement it, two or three other places in the frame, there will be a little splash of color that also complements that color and creates perfect balance in the composition, like of the sort that an art historian would go, yeah, they've been to a museum. They know what they're doing.
Yeah, and you know, like Demi actually went in and painted a lot of the storefronts for that film to sort of make everything as bright and as colorful as possible. And I think that Chazelle, in the same way, is giving you an LA that is like not really the LA that I live in. It's the one that when you think about it and you dream about it wistfully, like that's what it looks like, you know. And so these guys are, I think, well, they're telling musicals that are very much sort of at ground level in terms of not being about like aristocrats or larger than life individuals. You know, they're just about like run of the mill folks. They are definitely creating a sort of fairy tale setting in both cases that is this like idealized, you know, perfect dream version of the very specific cities where they're set.
Absolutely. Well, we got anything else? Anything else we need to... Any stuff?
The only thing I want to add to this is the question of success and selling out in La La Land. I just found it really funny because there are so many jazz musicians who would absolutely kill for a gig with John Legend.
Yes. Yeah, if you're going to have that, it can't be someone with the reputation of John Legend. Like, no one is seeing that character's name. That's John Legend, and he is respected and renowned by most musicians. I don't, like, that's not a bad gig at all.
It's not. And also, it's like, you know, jazz musicians do that kind of thing all the time and they're perfectly happy about it. They get it, you know, they're playing in little jazz clubs because that's the ultimate fantasy for them. But most of the year they're on tour with, you know, Fish or something, you know, and like Branford Marsalis was briefly the band leader for Jay Leno when he took over for Carson, and then he was part of Sting's backup band. And, you know, maybe there were points where he's like, God, this is no John, these guys are no John Coltrane or whatever, you know, but but more likely he was counting his money and feeling very grateful. And as my father always says, I would have been perfectly happy to sell out, but nobody ever asked me.
That's right. No one was buying. Yeah. I know that feeling.
For sure.
Now, I'll tell you, I've seen Umbrellas of Cherbourg at least 10 times, and I cannot watch that ending without sobbing. Like, I always cry at that ending, and but for different reasons. Jim Ridley has a great essay about this in the Criterion Jacques Demy box, where it's like, when you see it when you're young, oh, it's this heartbreaking tragedy, and then when you see it when you're older, you're like, well, yeah, that's how life goes, you know, and things just work out that way sometimes. Also, if I lived anywhere near a gas station that white and gleaming, I would go there all the time.
Yeah, that was a picturesque gas station, an Esso station to end all Esso stations, for sure. For me, the one thing that I felt when I watched I watched both of the movies back to back, so I watched them both in one sitting, and at the end of both movies, it could be very easily, like, my wife and I are both, you know, have careers and we do things and we both love each other and we make all that work. And so it's natural for me to look at Gosling and Stone and go, yeah, if you really loved each other, you could do both of these things. Like, I don't understand what the big deal is, but that is not how it works in Los Angeles. By and large, that's just not how life goes when you're trying to do the things that they're doing. And just like that, and I know you may disagree with that, Alonzo, because you live there, but just like that, in France in 1964, Guy is not going to go, hey, I want to see my child. I want to see my kid. I want to see this, you know, this is my child. I want to raise this. That would not be socially acceptable in that context. And so why you have that pull of your heart, is because you know what they could do, but you know that socially they're not going to do that.
Sure. I mean, like, he's even given the opportunity to sort of meet the child. He's like, let's just not even open that door. But also, I think the thing about this movie, and it's funny that I'm talking about with you guys, because, like, you know, Daniel, you married your high school sweetheart, and Matt, you married your college sweetheart. I think a lot of people over the course of their lives will meet somebody who is maybe very right in a lot of ways, but you're too young, you are not mature enough yet in yourself, you're still working out where your life's going to go and what it's going to be, and that opportunity goes away. And then later, maybe, hopefully, you meet somebody else, and that turns out fine, and you think back on the old relationship wistfully and you know, with, like, some level of, you know, like, you remember the passion, but at the same time you're like, yeah, that wasn't gonna work. I was 20 and a jerk, you know.
Yeah.
So I think for a lot of people this is the course of their lives where they do have that early relationship that sort of burns hot and then burns out. And then, you know, they look back on it in that sort of Barry Manilow song kind of way of like, well, we're with other people now, but boy, don't you wonder what might have been.
Yeah. Is there another, reading about this after I watched it, Jacques Demy, this is considered kind of his masterpiece. What's the next Jacques Demy movie I should be watching? What's the next Jacques Demy film for me, being new to the Demyverse?
I would say Young Girls of Rochefort. Now that you've seen Cherbourg, it's kind of an easy transition. It's not sung from beginning to end, but there are lots of musical numbers, and it includes Gene Kelly. So, you know, it's okay. A little bit more of a traditional Hollywood musical. And like I said, it like La La Land, it's about people following their artistic pursuits. But you know, it is also, like, made with that same kind of eye for color and for composition and the choreography and everything. I think you'll enjoy it.
I would make the same recommendation, and I would also say that it's just really, really great that you're doing this podcast, because I think that, I don't know where things went wrong exactly. Maybe the way technology has changed so that it's algorithm based had something to do with it, where people are constantly being recommended things that they already know they're going to like. And, like, you don't have that chance for discovery that you used to have when you were walking into a video store or going to a multiplex and the film that you wanted to see was sold out and you don't feel like going home, so you pick something else. Like, you know, we're sort of like being encouraged to stay in our own minds a little bit and not challenge ourselves. And this is a great way to get people to go into film history and see that it's not like, we're not doing homework here, folks. It's actually fun. It's fun. It's really fun. It's fun to go to say, oh my God, this is, it's not a slam against the recent movie to say, this movie is not inventing every single thing. It's drawing on a very rich tradition. It's putting a bunch of things together to make something new. And here are the things it's drawing from. I think that's cool. And now I feel like when I learn something it happens to me still all the time where I'll talk about a movie that I love and somebody will go, have you seen the silent film version? I'm like, I didn't know there was one. You know, it's kind of cool. And then I seek it out and I'm like, oh, now I have one more way in which to look at this thing that I love.
There's nothing wrong with standing on the shoulders of giants, but also to acknowledge the giants as well is pretty great. Matt, thank you for joining us on the first ever episode of A Film and a Movie. The movies that we watched today are actually streaming. The Umbrellas of Cherbourg is on the Criterion Channel. And then I found La La Land on HBO. You can also purchase it on Amazon Prime. That is the good side of the technology. It does try to keep us in our lane, but we also have the ability to stream a movie like The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which I would never have had the ability to do. in prior generations. So thanks so much, Matt. We really appreciate it. Alonzo, as always, thanks. And looking Matt, forward to doing this.
Matt, where can people find you online?
Oh, at Matt Zoller Sites, MattZollerSeitz. That's my Twitter handle. That's my byline. And you can find me writing about television at New York Magazine and Vulture, and film reviews at RogerEbert.com, and on Twitter complaining about people at the post office.
Fantastic.
And pick up Matt's books about Wes Anderson, about The Sopranos, about Mad Men, about Deadwood. This is must reading. He is I'm endlessly impressed with his acumen and his insight, and he's just fun to read.
And I'm going to stick around after we hit the stop button and make Matt talk to me about Deadwood for an hour, because no one here will talk to me about it. So that would be wonderful. Thanks so much. We'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
A Film and a Movie is a Bramble Jam podcast. It's produced by Brandon Gray and Daniel Thompson and recorded live in Greenville, South Carolina at the Bramble Jam Podcast Studios. For more information, you can go to BrambleJamPodcast.com.